My name is David Werdiger. On behalf of JBD, welcome everyone to our event with Rabbi Yossi Jacobson. A big thank you to Jonathan and ABL for hosting and providing a wonderful lunch, and a few attendees as well who don't have far to drive. Rabbi Jacobson is an internationally acclaimed speaker, and he is brought here by Chabad Youth, so I'll give them a very quick plug. What's my plug for Chabad Youth? Chabad Youth is a vibrant community-based organization who run a wide range of social programs, cultural and educational services targeting Jewish youth. They've got a very broad definition of youth. They're the number one providers of informal education programs, childhood through young adults in Melbourne. And they've got several divisions. They've got a volunteer program which helps with programs like tutoring and visiting the elderly and fundraising. They've got Tzivos Hashem, which is aims to revive Jewish identity in children. They run the largest Jewish camp in Australia with over 1,200 participants across several camps. Dominion is a vibrant community for young people, professionals. Chabad Sparks is a youth outreach program, and Chabad on Campus is for university students. And they bring out Rabbi Jacobson every year and run several events, and we're very pleased to have been given the opportunity to host Rabbi Jacobson here today. Rabbi Jacobson himself is, as I said, world-renowned speaker, travels the world saying cool things. He heads up an organisation called yeshiva.net, which is, I guess, open education, open Jewish education online. He's editor of one of the largest Jewish newspapers in the world, and because we're running late, let's get straight into it. Rabbi Jacobson.
Thank you.
Okay, we have David. Thank you very much. Thank you for hosting us today. I just arrived from Sydney, where I arrived yesterday from New York, and I'm pleased to be here. They tell an anecdote, which I would like to begin my comments with today, about Moshe Dayan. Moshe Dayan was a defense minister in Israel for many years. Many of you probably remember him, or his image at least, his photo with a patch on his right eye from a wound he received in the 1940s before the establishment of the State of Israel. And he was once, according to this legendary anecdote, traveling on an Israeli highway 145 kilometers per hour, which in Israel is not that fast, but still illegal. And a policeman stops him and sees who it is, and he says, "General Dayan, you ought to serve as a role model for Israeli society. You're driving like an imbecile, like a madman, and therefore I'm going to quadruple your summons." And according to the anecdote, Mr. Dayan looked at the Israeli policeman and he said, "Adoni Ashoter, my dear officer, look at me. I have only one eye. Now what would you like me to do with that eye? Look at the speedometer or look at the highway?" I do not know whether the policeman gave him a ticket or did not give him a ticket. I'm not going to be the nudnik. You know, they say the difference between the shlemiel and the shlemazel, and the nudnik is that the shlemiel is the guy who pours the soup on the shlemazel, and the nudnik is the guy who wants to know what type of soup was it. So I'm not going to be the nudnik to ask whether he got a ticket or not. However, his response, I think, has merit, at least in one of the major areas of life, namely, often we can focus on the speedometer and lose sight of the highway. And I say this as an introductory remark to my topic today about self-actualization and self-expression in the Jewish experience. Because I want to focus not on the speedometer, but I want to focus on the highway. There is a very interesting little Talmudic discussion. For those of you who have had some experience in Talmud study, perhaps today or in earlier years, you'll immediately be familiar with this type of jargon and conversation. Those who don't, will be initiated into it. But I want to show you how this, what would seem as somewhat an abstract and archaic Talmudic discussion that was transcribed 1700 or 1800 years ago, really has profound relevance to our own condition as humans and as Jews in the 21st century, whether in Australia or anywhere else in the world. In the Torah and the Hebrew Bible, there are two identifications to identify kosher fish from non-kosher fish. It's actually in this week's Torah portion, in Deuteronomy portion of Re'eh. The two signs to determine kosher fish are fins and scales. In Hebrew, snapir and kaskeset. Snapir are fins, kaskeset in Hebrew are scales. So if you catch a fish, if the fish has fins and scales, it's kosher. You need it. If it doesn't have both of these signs, it's not kosher. This is a classic biblical law by which Jews have lived for thousands of years till today. We'll eat those fish, whether it's the hecht or the carp or the salmon or the tuna, that have the fins and the scales. Gefilte fish or something else. So comes the Talmud and gives an observation 1800 years ago. A Mishnah in a tractate called Midah. The Mishnah says, a fact, any fish that has scales, inevitably it has fins. You will not find a fish that has scales without fins. However, there are fish that have fins, but they don't have scales. That's the observation of the Mishnah 1800 years ago. All fish that have scales automatically have fins, inevitably. It's a very interesting observation. It's actually a courageous observation to write 1800 years ago that this is the tradition for Moses. In fact, many years have passed. Many, many new species of fish, countless new species of fish, have been discovered. Indeed, fish that have scales, as far as we know, usually have fins, inevitably. The fins could fall off, but they naturally have fins. So the Talmud asks a very logical question. What's the question? Why does the Torah then give both signs? If when you have scales, you automatically have fins, so why the need for both signs? One is completely superfluous, excessive, unnecessary. Just tell us that if a fish has scales, it's kosher. Because if it has scales, it automatically has fins. Very good question in the Talmud. The answer given in the Talmud is three words, very strange words. Yagdil Torah v'yader, which means we want to make the Torah bigger and more powerful. So the Torah adds an extra sign for kosher fish to make it bigger and more powerful. It's a very enigmatic response. How does that make the Torah bigger? Just adding an extra word that's unnecessary, so you have one more word in the Torah. I mean, how much larger does it become? How much more significant or valuable? Usually throughout the Talmud, the trend is always to show that every word in the Bible is meticulous and there's no extra words. Suddenly here, a new idea, we want to make the Torah bigger. It's a strange answer, it's a very irregular answer. I want to today explain this discussion from a sociological, contemporary point of view, because one of the axioms in Jewish scholarship, especially in Kabbalah, in Jewish mysticism and spirituality, is that every law and ritual in Judaism contains parallel universes, to use the term in physics, which means it can be understood on a concrete level. It also mirrors metaphysical truths and ideas, whether spiritual ones, psychological ones, emotional ones, social ones. But in other words, the laws and the mitzvot reflect truths on different levels, not just concrete practical ritual, but also metaphysical ideas. There has been debates in the Jewish world from the beginning of time. Two Jews, they say, 19 opinions. Melbourne is probably a little better at this than the city I come from, New York. But even Australia has its share of ideological debates between Jews. I once heard from the late Lubavitcher Rebbe myself, he had a very good sense of humor, and he once said, why is it that when two Jews meet, the traditional greeting is Shalom Aleichem, And the response is, Aleichem Shalom. Why is the response not reciprocal? Shalom Aleichem, and you should say, Shalom Aleichem. I tell you, good morning. You don't say, morning good. You say, good morning. I say, how are you? You don't say, you are how. You say, how are you? So I say, Shalom Aleichem, peace unto you. You should say, peace unto you. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe responded and he said, no, with Jews it's different. The moment two people meet, I say to you, Shalom Aleichem, peace unto you. The first and immediate instinctive response is, you got it all wrong. It's exact opposite. It's not Shalom Aleichem, it's Aleichem Shalom. It's not peace unto you, it's unto you peace. Now we can begin a conversation. Now we can begin the Gedan. Now that we have established that we disagree, so we can begin the conversation. I think it was Mr. Jackie Mason who said that when two Jews meet and within the first 3 minutes they don't establish some type of familial relationship, one of them is not Jewish. That's one prerequisite. That's Mr. Mason's observation. My observation, humbly, would be if within 3 minutes they're not arguing about something, then I would say that certainly one of them should examine if they come from these blessed genes. But the point being here is that debates are essential. I once heard from Professor Eli Wiesel, who said that Jews have always been fighting. It's just they're more or less a sophisticated people, or they think they're a sophisticated people, so they give their fights sophisticated names. So, for example, they fight with the whole world, and instead of calling it a fight, they call it the study of sociology. Then they fight with God. Instead of calling it a fight, they call it theology. They fight with themselves and they call it psychology. The point is, you know, somebody once said there are neurotics and psychotics and psychiatrists. The difference is that the neurotics build castles in the air, the psychotics lives in the castles, and the psychiatrist collects the rent from both. But whichever category we or you fit into and so forth, there are many, many real and perceived arguments and debates. But if I were to ask you, tell me the core conflict that divided the Jewish world from beginning of time till today. Is there one argument that is maybe at the core of most arguments in the Jewish world? In Israel, in America, abroad, in various countries, whether in Australia, or wherever you go, it's manifested in one way or another way. Denominational, within synagogue structure. But I think, maybe this is a little bit of a daring or aggressive assumption, that many, many of the debates, if not all of them, or at least most of them, can be traced back to one fundamental issue. And this has to do with fins and scales. You know, there is a story in the Talmud, also in the Talmud, a very lovely story about Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was a sage who lived in the 2nd century after the Common Era. He was executed by the Romans in 136, or the day before Yom Kippur. He was executed by the Romans. Rabbi Akiva is considered one of the most celebrated sages in Jewish history. As far as scholarship and piety and his impression on Jewish culture till today, although he was killed in 136, that's quite a couple of years ago, is really unparalleled. As far as his mindset and his thinking, I mean, some of the greatest Jewish phrases, love your fellow as yourself, is the great principle of Judaism. That's Rabbi Akiva. And the Talmud says that he was teaching Torah despite the fact that the Romans prohibited it. And they arrested him. And a friend of his, a Jew, said, you shouldn't be doing this. The Romans said, no Torah education. You should stop. And Rabbi Akiva said, I'll give you a metaphor. And this is the classic metaphor of Rabbi Akiva about Jewish existence. And the metaphor was that there was a fox who was very hungry. And the fox saw some lovely fish in the ocean. So the fox came over to the fish, and the fox is considered a very clever animal. Foxes are very clever animals, if you've ever dealt with them. And the fox tells the fish, you guys are so insecure in the ocean because of the fishermen that come. Why don't you come out of the ocean and we'll go to a private place, you'll be able to live in serenity. And the fish responded, they say you're the most clever of animals, you're a fool. If even in the water we're insecure because we may be caught by the fishermen, if we go out of the water, it's an absolute sentence of death. At least in the water, we might live, we might be caught, but there is hope to live. Outside of the water, there's a certain death sentence. And Rabbi Akiva said that Jews are like fish in the water. When they're in the water, and he compared the Torah to to water, and the Jewish people to the fish. Here we may be suffering from the Romans, but there's a chance that we will live. If we go out of the water, then within a generation or two, five generations, we will disintegrate. We will assimilate like hundreds and hundreds of other cultures and faiths that are to be found only in Wikipedia, but nowhere else, including ancient Rome, ancient Greece, ancient Babylonia. This was Rabbi Akiva's argument in one of the, probably till the Holocaust, the darkest period of Jewish history, under Caesar Adrian, the 14th emperor of Rome, who was one of the worst and most horrific, till the Holocaust, probably the darkest period of Jewish history, the second century after the Common Era. But Rabbi Akiva had a certainty: if we remain in water, we remain connected to our culture, our tradition, our scholarship, our Torah, our lifestyle, we may survive. If we leave, we're not going to survive. Now we look 1800 years later, Rabbi Akiva had a point. The Jewish nudniks, who still drove the world crazy 1800 years ago, are still around, still making some problems or provoking people. Where Adrian and Rome, you can go to the Colosseum and check out the remnants or read about it in history. Now, what Rabbi Akiva was saying is that the fish is the Jew, the water is the Torah. So now you have fins and scales. I want to argue that the great debate in the Jewish world, from beginning of time until today, as I said, many manifestations can be traced back to this. Who are we? Are we parochial people? Or are we universalists? Or to put it this way, what is our success? Should Jews remain tribal, parochial, isolated, segregated? Or is our role as Jews to become fully integrated, to become universalists? This debate, in one way or another, has divided the Jewish world. In every era, in every milieu, in different ways, but certainly in the last few hundred years, when modernity has finally opened its gates and allowed the Jews to enter through its portals. One group of Jews argued, and still argues, our job is to remain alone, to remain completely insular. If the walls of the ghetto fell, we should artificially rebuild them so that we can protect our kin, we can preserve the integrity of our faith, our religion, our rituals, and we are really not interested in integration or being influenced or influencing. What our goal is to maintain our lifestyle, our faith, in a very strict and serious and intense formula. What's also known as the ultra-Orthodox or Hasidic or very frum or Haredi, it's known today, lifestyle and community. Where a whole other group of Jews says no. On the contrary, we're part of the world. Our mission is to be Orlagoim, to be a light unto the nations. We want ourselves and our children to be integrated as much as possible. We bless the opportunity to embrace modernity, to utilize it, to become citizens of civilization, of humanity, in addition to being Jews. It's really back, you know, to that anecdote when Golda Meir became the Prime Minister of Israel. She wrote a letter to Henry Kissinger, who was the Secretary of State of the U.S., and she said that she looks forward to a close working relationship. So Kissinger wrote back to Mrs. Meir, "You know, I do have to state to you my priorities. Number one, I am an American. Number two, I am Secretary of State of the U.S. Number three, I happen to be Jewish." So Golda Meir responds and says, "That's exactly why I look forward to a very close working relationship with you, because here in Israel, we read from right to left. So as far as I'm concerned, you're Jewish, and then you're a Secretary of State of the U.S. So there's really two ways of reading the world. I don't mean linguistically. Linguistically, you can read two languages from right to left, from left to right. That's not the issue. I'm talking about existentially, right? One segment of Jewish society said, we want to read from right to left. We have no interest in reading from left to right, only what we're forced to. Another group said, no, our role is to be part of the larger language, conversation, dialogue, and reality of society. That conflict has not been solved yet. I come from a little shtetl called Brooklyn, which you may have heard of, and if I take you through Brooklyn, I can take you to Park Slope, which is one section of Brooklyn, and I can take you to Williamsburg, which is another section of Brooklyn. I can take you to Borough Park, which is one section of Brooklyn, and I can take you to Soho, or Tribeca, or the Village in Lower Manhattan, which is another type of Brooklyn. In a more microscopic level, you'll have the same. In Melbourne, you'll have the same. In almost any established community the world over, certainly in Israel, you can go to Bnei Brak, you can go to Meir Sha'arim, and then you can go to Ben Yehuda or to Tel Aviv or Haifa, etc., etc. And the dialogue between the two groups becomes pretty strenuous. And really, there is a deep split. It's an ideological split. And I want to now go back to the fins and the scales. Because let's see how the Talmud is really addressing a very serious debate. What's the difference between fins and scales? Scales protect the fish. Scales, literally, are the armor, the shield, that safeguard a fish. You know, a fish goes from to different, is transported into different climates and atmospheres within the water. It can be attacked by other sea creatures and amphibious creatures. And the scales are the armor that the fish wears, so to speak, which protect them. Fins allow the fish to swim, to make progress, to go from one side of the ocean to another side of the ocean. Fins are wings. They are the wings that allow the fish to fly, to soar, to move. In Jewish history, there has been the debate, what is our most important feature? Or what makes us kosher? Fins or scales? Is our primary focus simply to maintain scales? To maintain strong armor, not allowing us to be penetrated by outside influences, to retain our inner heritage and identity and keep it intact thousands of years later and keep that circle going. I once asked a rabbi, what's your mission statement? He says, my mission statement is to do three things for my community. To hatch them, match them, and dispatch them. And I hope that the three happen in one system and in one structure. Keep that circle going. Don't look away, just maintain those scales. Another perspective is no. What makes us kosher is fins. Fins represents progress. The tefillin that we wear in the morning are the same tefillin that Rabbi Akiva wore 1,800 years ago and that Moses wore 3,300 years ago. There's almost no differences. The same is true with the way we celebrate Shabbat, with the talis, with the mezuzah. That's the power of ritual, it's the power of mitzvot, scales. The fins say, no, we're part of the historical conversation. We're part of the progress of humanity. Where we were yesterday is not good for today. There's a new culture. Embrace it. Accept it. Become part of it. Grow with it. Let it influence you. You influence it. Fins and scales. Two dynamics. Some say scales. Others say fins. Comes the Talmud and says this. If a fish has scales, it will have fins. But if it has fins, it doesn't necessarily have scales. The Talmud characteristically is making a powerful statement. And that is, if the entire raison d'etre of Jewish identity is just to fit into modernity, then there may be nothing left to us. If our entire mission statement is just to become part of the larger conversation of humanity, then we often forfeit our identity and our children ask us a simple question. Why are we doing anything that allows us to remain segregated? Why don't we fully integrate? There is a reason that the five children of Moses Mendelssohn, the father of Haskalah, the father of German Jewish enlightenment, he was a very religious Jew. He was an Orthodox Jew. He davened mincha every day. He prayed the afternoon service every day. But five of his children converted to Christianity in Germany. They had a very simple question. Why are you playing the game? If the larger conversation of humanity is what we're really striving to, let's do it right. Why do we need all these stereotypes? Why do we always have to experience the tension? Why the dissonance? Why not become like everybody else fully? So that's the danger of just having fins. What's left of you? Says the Talmud, if you have scales, you'll have fins. But if you have only fins, you may not have scales. So the Talmud now asks a big question. Why are fins one of the kosher signs? Forget the fins. Just have the scales. And here is where the Talmud introduces a third idea that I believe is so much missing from our conversation today in the contemporary Jewish world. And that is, to be kosher. It's not enough to have scales, you also have to have fins. And the three words the Talmud uses are Yagdil Torah V'yagdil. We want to make the Torah bigger. What the Talmud here is intimating is a very profound and important observation, and that is, we make a mistake when we identify the choice of Jewish existence between two polar opposites. Either you're going to be tribal, segregated, religious, observant, or you're going to be a man of, or a woman of society. You're going to be integrated. And we pit the two against each other. There is this perspective and this perspective. There are fins and there are scales. There are Jews who believe in segregation and there are Jews who believe in integration. There are Jews who believe in tribalism and there are Jews who believe in universalism. Very profound error. It's actually the other way around. Yagdil Torah V'yadir means the objective of Judaism was not to turn the Jews into a tribal people or to turn them completely into a universalist people. Why are we putting the two against each other? From a deeper Jewish perspective, it's actually the other way around. Our job is to have fins. Our job is to influence, to bring in positivity, to be a source of light, of inspiration, of goodness, of holiness, of morality into every segment of society, Jewish and non-Jewish, through the best of our abilities, through our home and through our community and through our work and through our businesses, through our friendships, through our relationships, to become a source of light and inspiration to the greatest sphere of influence we can have, every person according to their capabilities, talents, resources, locations, and so on and so forth. But why do we think that the more Jewish we are, the less integrated we are? From a Jewish perspective, it's the other way around. The more rooted I am in my own identity, actually, the more I can be confident and have influence on the larger society. There's a psychiatrist, a Jewish psychiatrist in Pittsburgh. His name is Dr. Tversky. He's probably here quite a few times. I once heard from him that he was traveling on an airplane. He is a Hasidic Jew. He has a square white beard, a long black coat, and a round black hat. The real Hasidic garb. And he's traveling on an airplane. An elderly woman turns to him and speaks to him in Yiddish. And she says, you know, Yiddish has curses that English does not have, because Jews over the centuries developed these very fine-tuned curses. And she says to him, du bist a Schande. You know what a Schande is? You are a disgrace. You are the cause of anti-Semitism. If you would only get rid of that foolish garb, which makes you stand out, and you could finally speak like everybody else, dress like everybody else, they wouldn't hate us. But people like you and your ilk always have to stand out and be different, and that's why they hate us. Dr. Tversky decided to do an experiment. He looks at her and says, excuse me, ma'am, I fail to comprehend your dialect. Maybe you're mistaking me for somebody else. I am Amish. Amish. She looks at him and she says, oh, I'm so sorry, I thought you were Hasidic. He says, no, I am Amish, I'm sorry. She says, wow, I love the Amish. He says, that's lovely, why do you love the Amish? She says, I just respect them. You know, you're such a minority, the Amish, such a minority, but you maintain your heritage with pride and dignity. I'm in awe of you, keep it up. Now it was his turn to respond in Yiddish. He says to her, aha, Oibich wollt gewen Amish. If I would have been Amish, you respect me tremendously. Just because I'm Jewish, you loathe me. I bless you that one day you should be able to appreciate in your own people what you can appreciate and respect in other people. Soon Rosh Hashanah is coming up. We're going to blow the shofar. Some of you probably, as children especially, have practiced the shofar, right? One of the things I liked doing as a child was practicing blowing the shofar from the wrong side. I told myself, what do I have to blow the shofar from the narrow side? Why not blow the shofar from the wide side? Did you ever try? Well, try it. Go home if you have a shofar, or ask your neighbor. Take the shofar on Rosh Hashanah and try blowing it from the wide side. You know what it's going to sound like? You blow from the narrow side and suddenly, if you know what you're doing. You see the symbolism there? When we try blowing shofar from the wide side, when we tell ourselves we are just part of everybody, then what happens is no voice comes out. We lose our unique contribution as Jews. When you blow the shofar from the narrow side, when you identify who you are, and you're very much grounded in who you are, then there is a voice that can be heard from the wide side, and it could spread further and further and further. In other words, that conflict between sins and scales is an illusionary. It's a delusional conflict. It really works the other way. The more I am grounded within myself, the more I am attached to my identity, to my family, to my history, to my faith, to my heritage, the more I can actually have a larger influence on the world, because there is a unique message, a distinct voice that Judaism can bring to the conversation of humanity based on its principles, its ideas, its perspectives, its lifeline, its vitality for thousands of years. When my mission statement becomes to be as inconspicuous as possible, to be as invisible as possible, to be as integrated as possible, then paradoxically, I'm not giving anything because I'm not proud of what I have, and I just melt away. So if I want to really have an impact, if I want to really have fins, then I need a strength in my scales. And that's what the Talmud is saying. To be kosher, it's not enough to have scales. To be kosher, it's not enough that you maintain your identity in an isolated fashion. Yagdil Torah v'yadir. Judaism is a message that must reach the whole world. The focus of Judaism on giving, the focus of Judaism on family, the focus of Judaism on education, the focus of Judaism on morality, on absolute morality. The focus of Judaism is on everybody being responsible, everybody being accountable, every human being having infinite dignity, every human being having infinite value, every human being in the creative image of God, every person indispensable to the process of history towards redemption, towards healing. These are principles, these are ideals that Judaism and the Jewish people ought to bring to the entire conversation of humanity. Yagdil Torah v'yadir. We need the fins to be kosher. We need the fins to make us kosher, because our job is not just to remain paralyzed and smug in one isolated cocoon, but to swim and to become part of the conversation of humanity. However, if we only have fins and we lose our scales, then you can have fins but end up with no scales. You have scales, you'll end up with fins. But fins are also indispensable to that kosher mission. And therefore, I once heard from Shlomo LeKalbach. Shlomo LeKalbach was a talented Jewish composer. You know who Shlomo LeKalbach was? And he once said as follows. He said, you know, I come to campuses, to universities in America. He said, and I meet somebody and I say, so what are you? And they say, oh, I'm a Christian, I'm a Catholic. And I know he's a Catholic. And somebody else says, I'm a Protestant. And I know she's a Protestant. And somebody else says, I say, what are you? And they say, I'm a Muslim. And I know he's a Muslim. And what are you? Buddhist, Hindu. And I know this one is a Buddhist. Then I come to one student and I say, who are you? He says, I'm just a human being. And then I know he's Jewish. Because one of our greatest struggles, our greatest identities, was to make peace with our Jewish identity. Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, ergo sum. And one Jewish comedian says, the mission statement of Judaism today is, I'm incognito, ergo sum. I am invisible, and therefore I am. So this is the great struggle between the fins and the scales. And really, it's time for us to appreciate the real truth, that the more we have scales, the more we have fins. I remember I was once speaking in a university, Florida I think it was, and one of the students said that we should abolish the family. The family structure is not nice, because all of humanity is brotherhood. Why is there such a thing, my family, your family? We should all be brothers and sisters. John Lennon's Imagine. So he did Imagine. There's no heaven, there's no religion, there's no hell, there's no countries. And this man said, imagine there's no families. We're all one big family. It sounds very idealistic, doesn't it? But in reality, it's one of the most dangerous ideas. Because somebody who grows up in a good, healthy, functional, loving family, they can actually be loving to strangers. Because they have a good identity. They can now have the mental space to really give to somebody else. When somebody doesn't have an identity, because they're told, you don't have a family, you're everybody's family, What happens is we can't be there more for humanity. We're there less for humanity because we're struggling to find ourselves. The more you're entrenched in family, the better relationship you have with your parents, with your siblings, the better relationship you can have with other cultures. The more secure you are with your own identity, the more you can appreciate diversity. Because you're not parasitic. You're not always searching for yourself. This is also true within religion. The more entrenched we are in Judaism, paradoxically, the more we can really appreciate diversity, the more we can contribute to diversity. Because there's a certain confidence and a certain wholesomeness from the fact that you know who you are. And when you know who you are, you can be very secure in giving to others who are not like you and in learning from others who are not like you. So in this great conversation of the Jewish world that continues, what makes a fish kosher? The Talmud 1800 years ago taught us a very profound lesson, and that is, we need scales. We need to preserve ourselves. And the more we go deeper into ourselves, the deeper scales we can develop. But there's something more than that. The deeper we go into ourselves, the wider our voice can travel. The more you can identify your own voice in a deep and profound way, which is always through education, through learning, the deeper you go into your own voice, the wider and bigger that voice will travel far and wide. Thank you very much.